Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly magazine of most things culturally considered. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. This week, conversations with Dan Hyatt, who is starring in the Aurora Theater production of The Arsonists, which is billed as a moral play without morals, and with Chung-hae Kim, harpsichordist and artistic director of Ensemble Mirable. Critic Peter Robinson offers a Civil War commemoration and a Margaret Thatcher memory, and Diane Keough will share her take on some recent cultural happenings. So stay tuned. Ensemble Mirable, an early music ensemble, is presenting concerts next week under the auspices of the San Francisco Early Music Society. The concerts, under the title Viva las Diferencias, will celebrate works by more than a dozen composers written between 1550 and the beginning of the 18th century, a time that witnessed a close cultural and political connection between Spain and southern Italy. At that time, both parts of the Habsburg Empire. I'll be talking with Chung-hae Kim shortly, but here's Ensemble Mirable performing the music of one of those composers represented on next week's concert, Giovanni Buonamente. Giovanni Buonamente's Ballo del Gran Duca in C major, an excerpt thereof. That will music of Buonamente will be represented this next week in concerts by Ensemble Mirable with Chung-hae Kim, who is artistic director and harpsichordist with the ensemble. Korean-born harpsichordist Chung-hae Kim has earned degrees from the Peabody Conservatory of Music, Oberlin Conservatory, as well as the Swaylink Conservatorium. She's also studied with Gustav Leonhard in Amsterdam. In addition to performing with the Ensemble Mirable, she has been heard as soloist with the New Century Chamber Orchestra and the San Francisco Symphony, among others. And I'm pleased to welcome her to the studios this afternoon. Welcome, Chung-hae.
Thank you so much. My pleasure to be here.
Very nice. Viva las Diferencias, the uncommon grounds and sonatas of the Italian and Spanish Baroque. What made this particular period of history, the mid-1500s, so rich with musical material?
Well, first of all, it was the beginning of the Baroque period that everybody was playing gorgeous music, and I thought it was perfect for spring music that has a rhythmic gesture to it, a lot of syncopation and Spanish music and guitar sounding. And we were playing, touring with an Italian program last year and the year before, and then I run into this wonderful music that I was keep reading and researching in the library, bumping into these pieces that I wanted to hear it, and then we read some of it, and bingo, here we go. I have to play this, and let's even see the relationship between Italian music and Spanish music, how they relate it. And you get to hear us if you come to our concert.
Indeed. Now, let's talk about the creation of the ensemble. This was the ensemble includes, first of all, Catherine Keim on violin, Kevin Cooper on guitar, Elizabeth Blumenstock on violin, yourself on harpsichord, and Joanna Blendolf on viola da gamba, with whom the genesis for Ensemble Mirabile was created back in Indiana. How did that relationship start?
Correct. Joanna Blendolf and myself, we were at Indiana University pursuing our graduate degrees, and we play quite often while we were at school, and we both moved to Bay Area. So we are the founding members, mm-hmm. and it created was 1996-97.
Right.
And from then on, we are playing. I guess it's already been so many years, didn't realize.
Right. Well, yeah. The time sure goes fast right now. I'm wondering what brought you to the harpsichord as opposed to, say, piano or some other instrument when you were choosing an instrument that would be your career instrument?
Let's see. My first instrument was piano, and that's such a long time ago that I'm not even... now I play harpsichord. I'm a harpsichordist, certainly. I picked because I was freshman in music conservatory at Peabody, and I was introduced to harpsichord, and I immediately fell in love. The purity of the sound and how it responds, and I play a lot of Bach then when I was teenager or younger, and it just makes perfect sense to me. This is how the instrument was doing it for. I don't have to make any adjustment to make it work. So when I was sitting in front of a harpsichord, I become harpsichordist on my first semester at school. That my minor become major and major become minor, and since then I never look back.
Very nice. Now, for listeners that may not know, I mean, there's a fundamental difference between the harpsichord, which was well before the piano, and that the harpsichord has a plucked string. Literally,
yes.
It was plucked using with a quill, with
bird
fashioned
quill.
From a quill,
yes.
A bird's quill.
Yes,
and it just up and hit the string and was allowed to vibrate, but it didn't last long.
That's right. That's just you explained perfectly.
Whereas the piano, when it was mm-hmm. developed in the 19th century,
yes.
has a big, quite a different way of producing sound.
Correct. First harpsichordus still exists was 1490. In 1492 in France. So it's about 500 years we have this keyboard instrument get developed, and unlike piano, there was many different kind of a harpsichord. You explain about how the harpsichord works and mechanically. Mm-hmm. What you just heard before the program was starting, that was Italian instrument, and there was a few other ones that it sounds different. The sound decays differently.
Right,
so if you
right.
wanted to do, like, for instance, Monteverdi, you wanted to have an Italian instrument. Why? Because it imitates the kind of blue, the Diorbo sound. It plucks right up front really loudly and dies very quickly.
Hmm.
Unlike French instrument, it decays really slowly and kind of blossoming the whole sound for a long time.
Interesting. So, so unlike the piano, which mm-hmm. became standardized over
correct,
time,
right.
there's all sorts of different types of harpsichords, aren't there?
Yes, and Flemish. And German, English, virginal. And also the temperament is different too, which is a tuning system.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, we need more time for talking
about temperament. Let's talk more about the harpsichord after mm-hmm. we hear your
sure.
artistry. We're going to hear just a brief excerpt of a piece by Jean-Henri d'Angobert from his Suite Number 3 in D minor. These are variations, Sur les Folies d'Espagne. music performed by Chung-hae Kim. Before we do that, tell us about the instrument we're going to hear on this particular recording.
That's actually my own instrument built by John Phillips in 1996 after I moved from New York, Europe. I commissioned him. I had to wait for like 5 years.
Wow,
and
okay.
And luckily in the Bay Area, there was many good instrument builders, and I also own by Kevin Fryer, an Italian instrument. And
we'll talk about those instruments.
So, but after this one is French, double by John Phillips.
Here is Chung-hae Kim performing music of Dongolbert. Virtuosic playing of Chung-hae Kim on a harpsichord built for her and a CD that was recorded here locally at the Skywalker Ranch. The CD is called Dongolbert, Pièce de Clavecin, 1689 Paris. That is some really beautiful playing.
Oh, thank you so much.
So what was the inspiration of just focusing this entire CD on Dongolbert?
Oh, Dongolbert has been my... great, my favorite, one of my favorite composer, and his music is very rich, and as you can hear all the ornaments, one of my friends call it a trailer park full of ornaments, but in good ways,
right,
that
right.
Even Bach himself admired him so much that he hand copied his ornament table and his notebook.
Oh, wow, I didn't know
and
that.
And it's absolutely gorgeous and luxurious music that one should study or listen. So I wanted to record this for a long time, and I'm so glad it finally came out about a year and a half ago. So
it's a beautifully produced CD, by the way. You can get that CD through iTunes. You can search for Jung-hae Kim, which is J-U-N-G-H-A-E-K-I-M, or look at JungHaeKim.com. You can order it from them. Let's get back to the Ensemble Mirabeau and the music that's going to be done. Well, actually, I do want to talk to you more about the harpsichord itself.
Okay.
You mentioned that you have another instrument that you have. How do you choose which instrument to play? Is it dictated by the year the piece was made or the sound you want to get out of the piece?
And the composer's nationality and when they wrote it and how they wrote it. And you can kind of tell by looking at their ears and where it's from. What are they trying to be emulate? So I'm basically, it's called historical performance. I want it to be as close to as what composer meant to play it on, or interpretation and treatise and all that.
Is it similar being a harpsichordist as it is being a harpist in that you practice 10% of the time, you perform 10% of the time, and 80% of the time you're tuning the instrument? Is that true?
Or people say for the oboe too. But it's very stable instrument. I would say I have a really good instrument that I don't have to spend so much time on tuning. It is true. But you have to tune quite often compared to piano or any other instrument.
And are either of your instruments a multiple manual? In other words,
I was alluding to
earlier that the... The piano evolved to having a single keyboard, usually 88 keys.
Right.
It's in a harp.
Right.
It can be different lengths. It can be upright, but that's the piano.
Right.
The harpsichord can often have two sets of keyboards.
I have a copy of a French Dumont, D-U-M-O-N-T, which is 1707 around there, which was one of the earliest double manual keyboard. And it's like organ that some has a one manual, some are two manuals, so sometimes even three.
Mm-hmm.
And so it varies.
Right.
Unlike,
it must be a challenge traveling with this instrument. And it's not something you can put on a carry-on or the transportation must be an issue for these concerts.
Yeah, it's not an easy tactic. If you have to travel a lot, hopefully they have an instrument. But my usually sitting in the airport is, I hope the instrument is in good shape. Since I don't carry my instrument around so much if it's cross-country, which is very difficult.
Of course. So most of the composers on this program are not really familiar names to, I think, most concert goers.
Mm-hmm.
Is that an intentional choice of yours? Is that something that Ensemble Mirabeau is trying to do to get these other composers more in the mainstream ears of the public?
The program that we're playing this next weekend is, some are well-known, some are not as well-known as lesser-known composers from the Baroque period, and we use period instrument. So we play the time of the composer wrote the piece was using as close as we can and use their instrument that they would have performed during that time. So the composer that we're playing is about 1510 to 1741 as Vivaldi's died. So 140 years of music. Since it's a period group, I didn't intend to put this composer, that composer. I just put it with whatever works with program itself. As I said earlier, the Spanish music has a lot of syncopation. It's, very fun and jazzy, and hope that people will go wild at the end. And even though one of the treatises says earlier La Folia was popular in Spain, 1600, it says fast-paced dance and participant should lose their mind at the end.
Oh my, okay.
So, and I kind of build up
the Tarantella had its
right. Yes,
short.
Yes. The build up the program around there and what would fit with that. And of course, the piece that you play before my solo piece was La Folia as well. It's coincidentally, didn't talk about this before, but that was later La Folia. So, which is very much like structured, and it expanded from 1600 Spain to other countries, Italy, Europe, and France, and then here we are at. Until I do some of this research, I probably should know, but I discovered that later La Folia is very different than earlier La Folia. So if you hear my... I'm going to play earlier La Folia by Frescobaldi, and then we have, at the end, we have a set of three other composers playing wonderful different La Folias.
Very nice. Now, who are you primarily choosing and researching the music that's being played, or is that a shared responsibility in the ensemble?
I do... a lot of it, and then we, you know, each our instrument is all different, we contribute as well, so it's all the cooperative work.
That's Chung-hae Kim, harpsichordist and artistic director of Ensemble Mirabel. They'll be performing next week at Palo Alto's First Lutheran Church on the 19th, St. John's Presbyterian Church in Berkeley on the 20th, and then here in San Francisco at St. Mark's Lutheran on Sunday the 21st. Information for these concerts at sfems.org. Chung-hae is going to be joined by Joanna Blendolf on viola da gamba, Elizabeth Blumenstock violin, Kevin Cooper guitar, and Catherine Keim violin. Once again, the Ensemble Mirabel, and the program is called Viva las Diferencias, the Uncommon Grounds and Sonatas of the Italian and Spanish Baroque. Chung-hae, thanks so much for talking with us today.
Oh, thank you so much.
We're going to hear one more cut from the album, which is called Influenza Italiana, Ensemble Mirabel. Could you tell us what we're going to hear? This is the track of Marco Uccellini, the aria Sopra la Bergamasca in D major, I think you selected. This is music of the Ensemble Mirabel. Thank you. Ensemble Mirabel, performing next week under the auspices of the San Francisco Early Music Ensemble, sfems.org, for more information. Good afternoon. I'm David LaTulipe. You're listening to Open Air. And Peter Robinson joins me now, and putting on a different hat rather than critic, he's going to offer some interesting things about the Civil War. And I understand April is an important month for Civil War people, buffs.
Well, it certainly is, because when the guns finally stopped over Fort Sumner and peace came to us as Appomattox, there are certain moments which continue in our history. And the Battle Hymn of the Republic is just one of those pieces. So I am going to look at the interesting lyrics, but first let's hear Whitney Houston.
It's the Battle Hymn of the Republic. You know the words. I know you do. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. He is trampling out the vintage where the grapes of wrath are stored. He has loosed his faithful lightning up his terrible sword.
Well, in fact, the actual lyrics went through two or three different stages. They were originally written by Julia Ward Howe, an abolitionist, and her carriage was passing through Union troops in 1861, and she heard them singing, in fact, John Brown's Bonnie. John Brown was also a Union soldier, separate to the abolitionist, and one of the lyrics they had originally included is, "We're going to hang old Jeff Davis from a sour apple tree." But that night she had a dream, and she felt it needed something more elegant, more elevated than to do that if it was going to have a place in our history. And so she wrote it the next morning, and in the February issue, 1862, of Atlantic Monthly, they actually published the poem and they gave it the title The Battle Hymn of the Republic. And the reason I think it's important is not only is it a song which really reflected the Civil War and how things finally finished at the end of April, the beginning of spring, but it has become enshrined as almost a second national anthem in this country. At the national conventions of both the Republican and Democratic parties, you'll hear this sung. And in fact, at the recent inauguration on January the 21st this year, President Barack Obama also used it, this time sung by the Brooklyn Tabernacle Choir.
Which is actually quite a surprise, really, when you think of it, when you start to listen to the lyrics. And, you know, I guess the separation of church and state has no place in inaugurations.
Well, it has no place, but that crossover about the spirit that it seems to create in people. For Winston Churchill, it was one of his favorite songs, and he requested it to be played at his funeral. And then Judy Garland, in a famous concert in 1963, wanted CBS to use it in respect to John F. Kennedy. They wouldn't let her mention his name, but they did let her sing it. At Robert Kennedy's funeral, this was the second song that they went out on at the very end. And if we look at American cultural history and literature, Carol Steinbeck actually used it as the title for John Steinbeck's 1939 masterpiece, The Grapes of Wrath, so it surfaced there. And then later John Updike, with the words "In the Beauty of the Lilies," also drawed on how this piece of music has finally found its way into the whole history of American culture. And finally, when we think about the great speeches of Martin Luther King, the Battle Hymn of the Republic really became his hallmark, not only after the march in Selma in Alabama, but also in that night before his final departure. he came out with the lyrics, "Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord." And that, in fact, was written by him in his speech the night before he was assassinated. So slowly, the Battle Hymn of the Republic has really become enshrined as something which takes us from the Civil War down to today, 2013, April.
Well, thank you for sharing that, Peter. Yeah, I understand you also have a remembrance of Margaret Thatcher to share with us today.
Yes, Margaret Thatcher's sad death earlier this week really took me back to some memories, because I was living in the England of Thatcher in the Thatcher years, and attended a couple of different press conferences where she had either called them or people were discussing different pieces of her policy. And when I say an assessment of Thatcher, it's only an assessment in the sense that she divided the country then, but ironically also divided the country in her death. There has been much controversy whether embassies, British embassies and civil servants throughout the world should be wearing black ties or funeral gear at the time of her funeral. Critics, and a good one would be Francis Mitterrand, would comment that she had the eyes of Caligula and the mouth of Marilyn Monroe.
Oh, my.
So that certainly takes your breath away when you think of that. On the other hand, she was a self-made person. She was the first female woman, I say female woman, it's almost a tautology, to become a prime minister, but it's worth emphasising. And indeed, she had gone from a simple schooling. Her father was a grocer, and then she goes on to Oxford and she establishes herself. So to that extent, she didn't have the route of private education like Winston Churchill and other prime ministers that took her to the position of power that she enjoyed. And some things she was absolutely right about. Perhaps the best example is the euro. As we look at the crisis that's evolved in recent years in Europe, the pound sterling, or the British pound, is still running high. And then there is indeed the question of the Falklands War. Again, it's another issue that hasn't gone away, but in terms of leadership, she was the person who, at a time of crisis, managed to launch what in fact was a transatlantic invasion across two oceans and call in help from her great friend Ronald Reagan. Even the word Thatcherism, I think, is an interesting word, because it really speaks about the second half of the British 20th century. In fact, she's one of the few prime ministers whose name has been given to a political movement. Now, my own memory goes back to one particular conference, and halfway through her political career, she had what we in the broadcast business would call a voice change, where she came down several pitches. She, in fact, had a speech therapist. And I remember at one conference, one person saying, "Prime Minister, with your now soft-sounding voice, you sound much sexier." To which she responded at high speed, "Do you mean to say that I wasn't sexy before?" Well, instantly enough, she was not a feminist. In fact, she only had her own self as the only woman in the cabinet. So my memories of her are, I remember the years that impregnated in our mind. Sometimes I think I prefer Meryl Streep as Margaret Thatcher rather than Margaret Thatcher as Margaret Thatcher.
Thank you for that, Peter. We'll have you back soon with some reviews. Very pleased to welcome veteran actor and Bay Area favorite Dan Hyatt, who is playing Biederman in the production of The Arsonists at the Aurora Theater. In addition to memorable local performances as Jacob Marley and others in A Christmas Carol for San Jose Repertory, and as Polonius in The Gravedigger and Hamlet at Cal Shakes, as well as the stages of ACT Berkeley Rep and Theater Works, he's been seen in Washington, Arizona, and his native Idaho, among other places and stages. He's appearing as Biederman in Alistair Beaton's new translation of a 1953 Max Frisch play translated as The Arsonists. It's a dark comedy which opens officially tonight at the Aurora Theater in Berkeley. It was in preview last week. Dan, welcome to KALW.
Thank you, David. Thank you very much.
Dan, the title gives away some of the darkness that's involved in the play, which was inspired by the communist takeover of Czechoslovakia in 1948. Can you give us a bit more of a synopsis, if you would be so kind?
I'll do my best.
Okay.
It's a very unique play, if you can have levels of uniqueness, but I guess the essential plot of the play involves, of course, arsonists who are taking over this city. And their M.O. is to arrive at a house as a homeless person or a salesperson and get invited in and given a place to stay for the night, and the next day the house is in flames.
So the character, I hate when that happens.
I know. So does Biederman. He suggests hanging all the arsonists. He's very bold and full of himself at the beginning. And then, of course, in the first scene, one of these guys shows up at his house. He ends up inviting him in, giving him a bed for the night. And the inevitable follows. But what we trace is how this happens, that an intelligent man who, you know, knows what's going on allows his home to be taken over by this supposedly evil force.
So in a way, it's kind of a morality play.
Morality play in an interesting way, that it doesn't really have a moral to it, or it doesn't. It has a shifting morality to it. And I think what it's saying, essentially, is that there's a moral spine that is lacking in this man Biederman. And perhaps that's because he doesn't really have a strong sense of, I don't know, self to pin anything onto. He seems to vacillate with the varying situations. As a businessman, he's ruthless and seems to be as amoral as the arsonist in terms of firing people, protecting himself. I think that's what it's about, is he's protecting himself. And rather than having a strong sense of self, he's constantly trying to project an image in varying places that varies with where he is, as opposed to the arsonists, who have a very strong morality, even if it's not an acceptable morality. They have a strong sense of self, and in that way, they are more powerful than Biederman. Initially, I thought of the poem by Yeats, "The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity." Except that Biederman isn't the best, I don't think. I think he has serious flaws.
The original work was in German. Max Frisch wrote, and this is a new translation by Alistair Beaton. Have you heard other translations of it? How does this differ from what's been out there before?
I have another translation that I took a look at, and it's very similar. This one is, well, this one particular translation is very different because there is a final scene that's added on where Biederman and his wife are at the gates of hell.
Is this Max's writing originally or not?
It is. It was tacked on. Originally, the play, I guess, was a radio play in 1953. And this was for a production, I think, in 59 or 60 in Frankfurt. And he added this kind of, I think, explanatory coda to the play, which I don't think you need. I think it's crazy, and it introduces many new characters, like a parrot figures strongly in the new epilogue.
Is this a live parrot or is this a Monty Python dead parrot?
I don't think the parrot has lines, so I think you could probably get an animatronic parrot if you wanted to. But our translation doesn't have that, nor does I think it needs it. Now, what our director, fine director Mark Jackson, who's famous around the Bay Area for creating tremendously visual spectacles of plays, and has a I think he has a penchant for the offbeat.
Okay.
And he was drawn to this translation because he feels that the other ones were more specifically tied to the communist takeover or to the rise of fascism in Germany during World War II. And he feels that this is a little more modern in that it's removed from that. And okay. I think we can find other modern parallels to take away from that, you know, materialism, the businessman who is essentially amoral, that kind of lack of a moral guiding force.
Director Mark Jackson has set the play in contemporary California. Now, is this site-specific or is it more a generalized California?
I think it's pretty generalized.
Okay.
It's what we have is Nina Ball, our set designer, has put together a set that is what I call architected to within an inch of its life, one of those homes that's very beautiful but not particularly comfortable. It's all about image and it's all about looks and it's all about leather and, you know, the nicest stuff. I have the fanciest wine opener and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that way, it locates it more in, a state of mind of California than a specific city or district.
Then you mentioned that Mark is a visually spectacular director. How, other than the set, what are we going to see on the stage?
Well, visually and aurally, his cohort, sound designer Matt Steins, has been with us from the beginning.
So this is original score, so to speak?
It's original score, and he's been there for every rehearsal. Concocting this thing, which is a very, very dynamic score of, you'll hear it, but explosions and fire engines and all this stuff that really, I think, really pops the play forward. Also, our lighting designer, Stephanie Buchner, is put together a nice climax of the play. But by visuals, I mean that there is a sweep to the play that I think, even though the play has profound philosophical underpinnings, I'm not sure you'll have much time to think about those during the course of the play. I think that's something that you'll be ruminating on after the play's over with. But it's an hour and a half that, for me, inside of it, goes by very, very quickly.
That's my guest, Dan Hyatt. He's starring in The Arsonists at the Aurora Theater. Who else is in the cast?
Well, we have Gwen Loeb, the inimitable, who plays my wife, Babette. And Dina Persia is our maid, Anna. Tim Niffen and Michael Ray Wisely are the fine arsonists. And then, interesting to this play, it, in addition to having elements of farce and agitprop political theater and situation comedy, it also has... I suppose if you twist farce a certain way, you can get tragedy out of it. And we have a Greek chorus of firefighters made up of Tristan Cunningham, Michael Kelly, and Kevin Clark, who have been working together they've been working more than any of the rest of us to create a choral sound, three voices that come across as one. And they're marching in and out in their firefighters' uniforms and playing other roles as well.
Interesting. I'm wondering if we could talk just a little bit about your own personal process of preparing for a role.
Oh, geez. I wish I had a process to talk about. I look at the play, and I read it, and I understand all the lines, and I create a story that makes sense of each line in sequence and what happens between those lines, and with the help of the director, find a shape for how those lines move in the course of the play to tell a story.
Hmm.
And that's pretty much what I do. Now, as you read those lines, you'll find that, I don't know specifically what that line means, so I need to find out more about wine, for example, or I need to find out more about arson.
So it's so much more than just learning the lines.
Yeah.
And part of my reason for the question is a bit selfish, because I am somewhat of an actor, more a commercial actor, and I'm a musician. And
right. Okay.
The memorization process has not as keen as it was in my earlier years. I'm wondering if you have a have a method of memorization that you fall back on? Do you record yourself? Do you run lines with your colleagues? Do you talk to your cat and hope for some response? Or?
You've been reading my mail. I mean, the last few years, I'm used to what it was like 10 years ago, 15 years ago. And so I go in thinking that that's what's going to happen now. And it's not what's going to happen now. What happens now is that I have to have a little more time. And, I do all of those things. I make a tape or a voice recording that I can use to cue me so that I'm not bothering people to say, will you run lines with me? I also run lines with the actors because it's very different when someone else is reading the lines other than what you've put down on tape. A couple of tricks I've found. One is work on it right before you go to sleep and work on it again right when you get up.
Preferably before or after a bourbon or before before rum.
I'm not sure that that's helping me. But it's not that I'm going to stop or anything.
Certainly not helping me.
But whatever you choose, probably in moderation, and then, go over your lines, go over what you need to learn that night and see if you can get through it. And I think the mind continues to work in its own way while you're asleep. And when you wake up, often it's eureka, I know these.
Or in your case, aurora.
Aurora. Yeah, it used to be the eureka years ago.
Okay.
But another great thing, just briefly, is if you have a long speech, write down one thought at a time, each thought on an index card. And that way you're learning individual thoughts, and you try to link those thoughts together, because that's how I'm speaking right now.
Mm-hmm.
This is a monologue that I'm delivering right now, but it feels like one thought at a time.
I'd like to think of it as a dialogue myself, Dan.
Well, I meant just what I was doing there.
Okay.
between your wonderful questions.
I'm told you find inspiration in the work of W.C. Fields, and you're a big radio fan as well.
Yeah, I often wonder if I was born too late. I think radio might have been a real fun place for me to be. It's funny because just the other night I have the Netflix streaming thing and I was looking for something and I saw, they got the Jack Benny program on here. So I started watching Jack Benny again, was laughing my head off.
Oh, Don.
Yeah, exactly. Very, very good. That's a good one.
I have to hold my hand differently.
I know.
Oh, Don.
Yeah. I don't know how he did it on the radio. Yeah, once you could see the takes, what was going on during the laughter, that made such a difference. But I am enamored of all those old comedians, W.C. Fields, the Marx Brothers, Jack Benny.
What I wish they'd do with some of those streaming issues, reissues, is to incorporate some of the original advertising.
I said that the other night. When they go to commercial, I was watching the Dick Van Dyke Show, and when they go to commercial, it just cuts to the next scene, which is nice sometimes, but I just wanted to see, if you need Oxidol,
exactly.
See the guy talking about Ipana toothpaste. I love those things.
Yeah. Now, your very rich acting life has seen you in many, many roles. Do you have a preference for contemporary or classical roles? Do you have a favorite role that you like to go back to?
I think if I chose any, I think I would say that what I had the most success with over the years is farce, which is great because I feel several of the scenes of The Arsonist feel like they're right out of Noises Off or a Feydeau farce. It's the same thing. It's a man in over his head, a man who's slightly full of himself, somewhat of a stuffed shirt, who's in over his head and trying to get back to normalcy. So I would say that in general, that's what I've enjoyed most over the years. Whether that happens in classical or contemporary, I don't think it matters. As the years go on, I have more and more of a profound appreciation for Shakespeare, just gradually seeping into me over the years.
Or whoever wrote those plays.
Whoever wrote them. Who cares?
Exactly. How about a dream role? What's your dream role?
Oh. Well, I'll never play it. I don't have the gravitas, but King Lear would be a great one.
Mm-hmm.
I'd settle for Gloucester.
And happy on the stage, or do you have other ambitions on the film front or television, perhaps?
No, I've always been at home. I've always felt that the theater feels like home, and the other front hasn't felt like home to me. It hasn't felt like I belong, for some reason. I don't know why. But as I get older, talking about this learning lines thing, and it wouldn't be bad, as I think about it, to do a short take of something. A few times, a few lines at a time.
Sure.
Maybe I'd like to learn how to do that finally.
And with most actors, there's always some sort of a directing ambition. I'm wondering if you've taken on the director's chair.
No, I don't. I don't feel that I have the skills, the visual skills for that. The way to, it might be possible to learn, I suppose, from a master like Mark Jackson, but I don't feel that I have the visual skills to put together, to coordinate all the design and the staging to create a visual.
So you remain the wizard and not the man behind the curtain.
Yeah, that's
good.
Right.
That's Dan Hyatt. He's starring in The Arsonists. It's at the Aurora Theater. Opens tonight and runs through May 12th. Information at auroratheater.org, The Arsonists. Dan, thanks so much for taking some time with us today.
Thank you. I had a great time.
And to conclude this week's open air, we'll welcome back our gadfly on the cultural scene this week with some information both from the stage, the screen, and the TV screen. Diane Keough, welcome back to open air.
It's good to be back.
So what have you been seeing on stage?
Well, Saturday night I went to the world premiere of Being Earnest at Theater Works. It is obviously from Oscar Wilde's The Importance of Being Earnest, and it has music in it. Now, it's not a musical. It's a play with music, and there's a big difference, as you know. But if you can imagine yourself back to 1965 with the ugly, ugly furniture.
I was two, just to rub it in.
Well, at any rate, the furniture was ugly. The men's clothes were absolutely ridiculous. The girls wore high boots and short skirts and Mondrian dresses, and everything was changing and different. And that's also what was happening in 1895 when Oscar Wilde wrote this, The Importance of Being Earnest. So what we have are two rakish young men living in London in 1965, and one of them has a country home. They are in the definite upper crust. All of the words that are in the play are from Oscar Wilde. So you know you're laughing all the time, or you're thinking, one of the two or both. And some of the things that they had said in there didn't even come from The Importance of Being Earnest. They picked them from other Oscar Wilde things, which I thought was great, because it added to the feeling of him. He's a brilliant writer and a great humorist. But at any rate, we have the two young men, and one of them has a house in the country. His name is really Jack, but he calls himself Ernest in the country so that he can come back and forth and not have any problems. The other one's name is Algernon. Algernon is his good friend. And then we have the Lady Bracknell. Lady Bracknell is so well known for being some kind of a harridan, but not really, but terribly much in charge of everything. Her nieces, her nephews, her daughter, anybody that she knows, she's pretty much in charge of. And she is wonderful. But the story goes on, and I'm sure that most people know the story of Being Earnest, the importance thereof.
Well, you can refresh us.
Well, okay. As we have Jack, he goes down to the country, and he is Earnest down there, but Jack in the city. Algernon has been told not to come down and visit him, but wants to come down because he's heard of Cecily, the ward of Jack Earnest. And, of course, as they did back in the 1890s, and in sometimes today, they fall in love immediately when they meet. And what we have also is Lady Bracknell's daughter, who is in love very much with Jack, who is Earnest in the country. Well, they get down there, and everybody is now being called Earnest because Algernon comes down and says he is Jack's brother, Earnest. So we have two Earnests. The girls think that they are both the same person, which obviously they're not. So the girls get very upset. And they have a couple of songs which are pretty good. One of them is called Wonderful. everything is wonderful. And of course, some of the things that are wonderful are ridiculous. But the two voices of the men were so great. They used to sing, they sang a song called Brothers. It was very witty, very quick. And as the play moved along, the words changed. The song stayed the same, but the words changed. So a different song was sung in London than was sung when they got down to the country. And then, of course, Lady Bracknell said, "You cannot marry my daughter because we don't know who your father was." And it turned out that he had been left in a bag in a railway station. And, of course, she said she's not going to let anybody marry into it that has a bag for a father. So down in the country they go, and it all ends up very well. It turns out that he was the baby that was left in the bag, and it was supposed to have been a manuscript left in the bag, and the baby was in the bassinet. But, of course, that got turned around, as many things do in plays like this, and it all turned out very well because he found out his father was quite wealthy, also who was a cousin of Algernon, and his father's name was Ernest.
Okay, we need some work on Cliff Notes versions of the classics, Diane, but there it is.
Well, it wasn't exactly a classic. I mean, it wasn't.
Yeah, Being Ernest is at Theater Works Silicon Valley through the 28th. Visit Theater Works, that's theater, reworks.org for more information. On the musical front, let's go quickly to musicals.
Okay, there was a musical that I saw, and I know you're going to say this again, but I saw it 30 years ago, called Cats. When it came out, it was originally from London and came over to the United States in 1965. Yeah. And it came out and it, yeah, 60.
I can't imagine it's that old. It's got to be like 85 or something.
85. 75. 95. No, it's over 30 years old.
Oh, my gosh.
Well, anyway, whatever age it is, it was very well done.
Ageless.
Well, it is kind of, because it's interesting. It is ageless. There were 22 kids on stage, and I say kids because most of them were young, and they were
22 cats on stage.
22 felines on stage. Yes. And they were wonderful. The stage setting was very similar to the one I saw in New York. It only requires one stage set. It's a junkyard, and you have junkyard cats. So it's the typical story. They great singing. But there were two people that stood out for me in Cats, which is, by the way, I'm sure that everyone knows, the T.S. Eliot's Old Possum Book of Practical Cats. And all of the poems in that book are set to music so the cats can sing them and introduce themselves to you that way. But one of them that I thought was outstanding was Jas Motsbacher. He is a recent Stanford grad with a lot of experience in musical theater. And he was Rum Tum Tugger, had a great voice, was a joy to watch, was very interesting, couldn't take your eyes off of him when he was on the stage, and he was absolutely brilliant. The other one that I thought was great, and it turned out that I knew that she was who she was, because she sang Memories. She was Grisabella, and she sang it in such a way that you felt it. And it turned out that she was also Rose in Gypsy, which we reviewed here, and I felt the same way about her voice. Then she is an excellent, excellent singer.
Going places. That's great.
And so that's the story of Cats, and that is at from the 6th to the 21st at the Fox Theater by Broadway by the Bay.
Oh, perfect.
And there's plenty of parking in garages around there, so if you run into, you know, a lot of folks coming down there.
We're going to have to save your foray into PBS for another time, but I understand there's a musical version of Twelfth Night coming.
Twelfth Night, the musical.
It starts. Very quick synopsis of that, or what's going on? Who's
starting tonight at Notre Dame? It's Twelfth Night, a set to music and dancing and updated with a lot of Shakespeare in it, but it's going to start tonight at Notre Dame Theater in Belmont. Runs tonight and tomorrow, next Friday and Saturday, and next Sunday noon.
Thanks, Diane. That's a little bit of something to look forward to here in the Bay Area, and thanks again for coming on and sharing that with us.
It was fun.
There's a very special concert coming up this coming Sunday, which features music from the opera, Broadway, and the Great American Songbook, this Sunday at 7 at the Palace of Fine Arts Theater. It's Sing for America. It's a 60-voice chorus put together especially for this event, not only as vocalists, but they act as cheerleaders for their favorite charity of choice, whether it's another chorus they sing in or a favorite cause. Now, even though this is intended as a fundraiser, we've been offered 5 pairs of tickets, and we'll offer them now to folks who call 415-841-4134. The concert will be emceed by the legend of stage and screen, Clive Reville, and will have many incredible guest artists, including San Francisco Opera Chorus conductor Ian Robertson, Broadway star Lisa Vroman, who was in Phantom, as well as Aspects of Love, among other shows, celebrated jazz singer Billy Valentine, the wonderfully zany men's group called Hearts of Romaine, and a lot more, including some San Francisco opera singers, Rochelle Perry and Frederick Matthews. Details at singforamerica.org. Again, 415-841-4134 for tickets for this Sunday evening concert, 7 o'clock, great venue, the Palace of Fine Arts Theater on Lyon Street. Thanks again to Peter Robinson for his Civil War reminiscence, as well as his take on Maggie Thatcher's departure, as well as to Diane Keough for sharing some cultural events, and of course to my co-producer Niels Swinkels for helping make things happen here. I'm David LaTulipe. You've been listening to Open Air. Thanks for listening.